Lima.
Hello, Dr. Lima. Life Talk with Marietta here. Thank you for being our guest today, and a big hello to our audience.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Nice to have you here with us today. Heart to Beat, a cardiac surgeon's inspiring story of success and overcoming adversity the hard way. This is our topic. And before we get started, this podcast was brought to you in part by KmarEducation.org and AbetterViewCleaning.com, Connecticut's best-known service for commercial and residential window cleaning, AbetterViewCleaning.com. So, Dr. Lima, you are on the stage now, and I'd like to ask you, you said in your book, we, meaning you, not you, but us, are the key to our own success. Not because we're special, but because success is earned, not bestowed. And when did you decide to write Heart to Beat? And why?
So, yes, I get that question a fair bit. It's a very fair question. I never, as a heart surgeon, would have thought that I would write anything outside of, you know, the medical literature.
Yes.
And really, I was early in my practice after training. And the thought of it just came to me in the middle of the night. Literally, I was awakened from sleep, and it was just like this flurry of ideas that I jotted down. And it just kept growing and growing and snowballing over time. And it were really just things that I had appreciated from my past, kind of reflecting on the journey, what I've been through, what I'd overcome. And I kind of was overcome with this sense that I really needed to share that story, because I really felt that I could help others, with what I gleaned from my past and really help others reach their full potential.
Could we go into your past? Do you mind if we go back to the childhood, how you grew up? Were you raised with praise, and so forth? Could we immerse into your childhood?
Absolutely. It's one of my favorite topics. So, I was born in New Jersey, but my entire family, my parents and two older siblings, came over from Cuba. They came over in 1968 on the Freedom Flight. So, basically, they were fleeing. They were seeking political asylum in the United States because of the oppressive communist regime of Castro. And they arrived here not knowing any English, not really having much in the way of finances at all. So they were starting literally from scratch. And my dad had to work wherever he could find a job. And he found a very taxing job at a pigment factory for paint in a very rough neighborhood in Newark, New Jersey. And, he worked countless overtime shifts. The working conditions were pretty awful. He inhaled fumes from where he was working. And we lived in a cramped apartment, only spoke Spanish at home. And that was really the environment. But my parents were amazing. They were very loving, very caring. And really, my father in particular, instilled in me, he cultivated this sense that as long as you're willing to put in the work, nothing is beyond your reach. He really helped me kind of embrace that concept that, sure, there's people out there that maybe they're born with more natural talent, smarter, gifted, but there's a lot that you can overcome with just sheer work ethic. And that, I think, is what's really been able to catapult me to where I am today.
Doctor, are your parents still with you?
No. So that's a whole other part of the story, which I share in Heart to Beat, is unfortunately, they didn't know any better. The usual, our idea of healthcare was when you're deathly ill, you go to the emergency room. They didn't believe in preventive care or seeing your doctor every year or screening for cancer. So my mother passed away from metastatic colon cancer.
Ramona.
Yeah, Ramona. That's right.
Papalino.
That's right. So So she passed away at the age of 65 back in 2004. And, you know, more than likely, if she had gone and done her screening, you know, as most people should, in her 50s, they would have probably found something precancerous, a small little polyp that would have been taken out, and that would have been the end of it. But when it finally came to light, she had, you know, pretty advanced cancer. And my father passed from heart disease. He had required heart surgery. And really, that was more of the Cuban diet that he enjoyed, you know, high salt, high fat. He passed away at the age of 78. So, yeah, I did lose them. And so not having them in my life has been also another huge hardship and struggle that I've had to overcome.
I'm sorry about that, doctor. I really am. I think everybody can understand what it feels like to lose parents, including myself. So it's very tough. So
very tough.
Take us back to your 5-6 years old, and what was it like? Were you very open to learning? Were you also praised a lot? Did you grow up being praised a lot?
I was praised. However, I was a very mediocre student, meaning I do remember vividly being told that I have, quote, ants in my pants. So I was very fidgety. You know, I think today I probably would have met criteria for having, you know, ADHD or something like that.
Sure.
I couldn't stay still. Mm-hmm. I was talking.
I know why, doctor. Because you think fast. The kids thought very fast. And whatever wasn't of interest, of course you're fidgety. I was the same way, doctor.
So I was really not a great student, you know. But my parents were never really overbearing or, you know, they never expected straight A's or anything like that. This was, you know, as long as I did my homework and, you know, they were very, very loving. I mean, in that department, I hit the lottery. I really, really lucked out, which is saying a lot because, you know, there are many, many kids out there who don't have that, who are desperately lacking that or only have one, you know, live in a single parent home and the like. So in that department, I had a amazing childhood.
Wow. And coming from, as you said, a mediocre student, how did you climb the ladder? Because a mediocre student, we always need to be stimulated and find our own interests. So how did the next steps come about?
So this was, I would say, one of the most pivotal moments in my life. And it's odd to say because it happened at such an early age. It was my 8th grade graduation, which is usually not a major occurrence, you know, a typical thing. But in my case, I just remember like it was yesterday, my close friend, he's from an Italian immigrant family, my buddy Gerard. He won everything, every award. He called up the stage a bunch of times for math, for science, and I just remember sitting there almost like it had never dawned on me leading up to that, there's actually going to be a forum where awards are given and recognition for, you know, effort and this, that, and the other. And I just knew that I really hadn't, you know, applied myself at all, really. I kind of had just been going through the motions. And it was just something about that realization that I hadn't given my best effort that was so unsettling. It really, really affected me. It really upset me. And I kind of woke up. You know, all the stuff my dad had been talking about, how hard work and this, that, and the other, it finally hit me, you know. And so I was like, that's it. This is never, ever happening again.
Wow. At that early age. That's incredible. I know exactly what you're saying, doctor. I do.
Yeah, so when I got to high school, so right, you know, that following fall, you know, or a couple months after that, I was a totally different student. I approached it differently. I was very, very just conscious of what I was doing, and I really, really rolled up the sleeves and put in the work.
I know when that feeling, it almost has to be so low within us. That a lot of people would get stuck feeling that, but it made you rise. It made you do something about it. That's the difference.
Yeah, because, you know, the reality is there are going to be plenty of times, and I certainly happened to me, where even when you do your best, you know you left no stone unturned, and it still is not enough. And there are going to be those times when you fail, where you didn't get what you wanted, and you missed the boat. But the difference with that is that, you know, on your end, you can say, well, I did all that I could do. There's, you know, and I can live with that. I can't live with, well, I really was lackadaisical. I didn't really put forth much effort. And, you know, this is not the result I wanted, but, you know, I deserve it. I can't live with that. I can live with, well, it didn't go my way, but I know at least I did my best.
Yes, it's rising. It's really rising. Instead of feeling, they always get the praise, and look at the poor me. I know exactly what you're saying, Doctor. It's about rising at that moment and doing something. Getting, it's almost like this inner core strength that lifts you up, and then you go forward, and then you just won't accept that anymore of yourself.
It's you know, because what I did witness many, many times, because there's two parts to, you know, there's the hard work, of course, but then there's also the complacency. So that's the second half of the instruction that my father imparted was, you know, whenever I did anything, you know, that I was proud of, you know, I did great on a test or whatever it was, he would be super proud and happy and, you know, hug me and brag to his friends and family and all that stuff. But, and his timing was unbelievable. He would also say, all right, well, don't rest on your laurels now. You know, keep at it, you know, so almost saying, hey, I got you, you know, it's great that you did what you did, but it's not over yet. There's more ahead. So reload. And so that part, that second part, I think is also a huge difference maker.
Yes. And I'm sure when you mentioned in the beginning that your dad worked in a factory, that he actually lived the lifestyle of not being complacent. In other words, it's just he wouldn't teach you that. He wouldn't,
exactly.
You know,
exactly.
You have to learn, you have to live that in order to pass that on to your children. It's a constant, it's a lifestyle. It's every day, all the time. You start off at a lower position, and you always move, you know, to better yourself. That mindset he passed on to you, that is incredible. I like to talk about that we don't have to be the smartest in the room, but we have to want something badly enough. Could you talk about that?
Yes. This became more apparent to me when I went to college. So in high school, yes, I was able to work harder than everybody else, and I was able to graduate number one in my class. I got lucky enough to get enough scholarships to go to Cornell, an Ivy League school. So here I was at an Ivy League school, far and away, above and beyond anything in my wildest dreams that I would ever even been able to attend a school like that. We certainly could have never afforded that if we had to pay for it on our own. But right then and there, almost immediately upon getting there, it hit me, because as I was meeting some of the incoming students and other students, I was like, wow, these, you know, students that had gone to the most prestigious and elite academies in the United States, kids from all over the world, kids that are all, you know, they were all valedictorians. I mean, the smartest of the smart. And I could assure you that I was definitely, definitely on paper, not the smartest. I didn't have any AP credits. You know, a lot of these kids that I was running into had 25 AP credits, and they had placed out of all intro classes. And, but I worked harder than all of them. And what I found is that many of them had become so accustomed to success, they were just used to it, that when at the first hint of failure or not, you know, getting an A, they kind of let, you know, let loose a little bit. They didn't, you know, they couldn't handle it. They couldn't handle failure or a setback. They couldn't reload and get back on the horse. Whereas I did, I just kept going and going and going like an Energizer bunny. And that's...
that pink bunny, yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, you know, for me, I had a lot at stake. I was on a scholarship. I had something to prove. This was a long shot for me. And I was not going to allow it to be wasted. This was a precious, precious opportunity that I was lucky enough to have. And so there was no way that I was going to give up easily at all.
Doctor, I'd like to go back to the eighth grade when you had the pivotal moment. And when you started the journey of really, really going after and making things happen on your journey as a youngster, if you will, how did you feel? How did you feel as you were putting success into your archives? How did you feel about success? Were you still humble? Were you getting a little, you know, oh, wow, I'm really great at this? How did you work with that?
Well, I would say it was difficult not to remain humble because it seemed like there was always another more difficult foe that lay on the horizon. It was, you know, because, you know, okay, I got to college, you know, fine, I had done great in high school, I was, you know, valedictorian, and then in college, I was, you know, competing with these amazingly talented students from all over the world, so I had to really step up my game. I just felt, and I was taking examinations that were so much more difficult than anything I had encountered in high school, so I had to prepare that much harder. And after navigating that whole gauntlet, medical school, you want to talk about competition, my class at Duke, you know, 100 students in the incoming class, I was one of the 100. You know, you're talking 20 from Harvard, 20 from Yale, 20 from Duke, 10 from Cornell, you know, the most talented and gifted students from the most elite universities in the world, you know, handpicked. And it was tough. You had to be humble. There is no way you could walk around like you owned the place there. It was impossible. You were quickly reminded of what you know. So it was, I think the path that I had chosen almost in and of itself did not let you get too cocky or confident.
I was just Yeah.
It had a way of reminding you very quickly.
But it's also natural when you've learned to depend on your accomplishment. That's a hell of a thing. That's a hell of a thing. And to get cocky then, I can understand that too. But then life kind of puts a person back in, you know, on the right track. I've learned that too. Nobody is the fastest. Nobody is the best. And it's not just about, oh, you're in front all the time and don't let people next, you know, to the left and to the right. I've learned that. But I think it's part of self-praise or self, it's an illusion. But it's still natural to go through that. You know, when you earn that you can depend on your accomplishment, that I can do anything I put my mind to. I think it's natural. I like to believe that.
Me too.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah, yeah. And I learned I'm not the best. I'm good. But I'm not the best and I'm not the fastest. So, and that's, it took me almost all my life to learn all of that. So that you had that moment in eighth grade, that wake up call, that wake up moment, that's incredible. And let me ask you, how long have you been a surgeon?
So I graduated medical school in 2002, and training for heart surgery to become a heart surgeon is 10 years. It's changing a bit now just because the field has evolved and they're having trouble getting people to commit to that long of a training period. It's the longest training in all of medicine. So I finished my heart surgery training in 2012. So this is my eighth year out in practice as a fully trained heart surgeon.
That is incredible. And when did you actually, what year, a couple of years ago, when you sat down and you started writing the book and,
Yeah, so it's been a handful, I'd say almost as many as 5 years when the idea first came to me. Mm-hmm. And I just, every chance I would get, a free moment here and there, I would, more thoughts, more inspiration would come in, I would write more notes. And so it started piling up, and it's really over the last 2 years that I've been able to put it all together and finally make it an actual book, an actual, you know, beginning to end, coherent story. That's what was difficult, is organizing all these random thoughts and reflections into a cohesive book.
I hear you. We're talking to Brian Lima. Let me tell everybody your website, BrianLimaMD.com. And there's another website, Heart2Beatbook.com. So the two websites. And I also want to mention to everybody that Dr. Brian Lima will be on our live radio program, Life Talk with Marietta, on January the 26th, between 7 and 8 Eastern Standard Time. That's WICC600.com worldwide, and of course on the dial in Connecticut, Long Island, and New York, it's on the dial 600 AM. So, and we already have the title, As a Man Thinks in His Heart, So Is He. It's a roundtable discussion with some other very interesting, resilient people.
Love it.
Yeah.
Love
so
it.
We just, the title was just born this morning, so out of a conversation. And
Great.
Yeah. So I want to get into Till Death With My Heart, All In or No Win.
Yes. So that is a chapter, the later chapter in the book, where I talk about the idea that if you're really pursuing something that you're going to call your calling, that is your calling, something that goes beyond being just a job per se, but something that you're truly passionate about, that is not going to be just some self-serving, you know, mission, but something that really has greater good within it. It's not going to be easy, and chances are you're really going to have to sacrifice a lot. Sacrifice time, sacrifice being able to be all things to all people, you know, people in your personal life, friends, family. The whole idea of being, quote, well-rounded, I think is a misconception, and I talk about that. There's only one of you, and it's widely known that it takes, you know, if you agree with Malcolm Gladwell and his book Outliers, 10,000 hours to attain mastery. Well, 10,000 hours that's a lot of time. There's only one of you, and you can't possibly at all times or all phases of your life be that, quote, well-rounded person. You know, think of Olympic athletes that train unbelievable hours for that gold medal. This is the same thing. And in that chapter, I talk about how that looked like in my life. And where I specifically remark on this is my heart surgery training. I went to the Cleveland Clinic. It's, widely considered the mecca of heart surgery, the busiest heart surgery hospital in the United States, probably the world. And I did not see the light of day for 3 years. If I wasn't operating, I was taking care of patients, or I was practicing my suturing. Because, you know, you only had one shot here and there. You know, the world famous surgeon would give you the suture and say, okay, kid, see what you got. If you fumbled around and didn't almost look like you knew what you were doing, you know, that was it. You whiffed. That was your audition. Mm-hmm. Back to the, you know, end of the, you know, back to the, you know, warm up in the batting cage or whatever. So you had to make it count. And as a consequence, I had a failed marriage, you know, because really I was an absentee husband, figuratively and literally, because I was married to my passion for heart surgery.
Yes.
That's the price I paid. And I lost in the process my identity a little bit. I mean, the price sometimes you pay for going all in is sometimes you forget who you are as a person because it's all wrapped up in that pursuit. I didn't
yes.
know who Brian Lima was anymore. It was Brian Lima, the heart surgeon.
Yes.
And because of that, after I finished my training, you know, I talk about this in the book, you know, I was far from well-rounded. I was newly divorced, out of shape, burnt out, and I went and took a job in private practice in Texas, in Austin, Texas. Not at all what I had thought I was going to do, because I thought that I was going to, you know, go take a high-powered, prestigious position at a big-name university medical center. But I needed to sort of regroup. It was almost like a sabbatical where I rediscovered who I was, got back and kind of got back into that, quote, well-rounded type mm-hmm. of state. And once I kind of recharged after a year or two, I was ready to get back into it, to get back into the fray. But this time around, I had a better sense of who I was. I knew now how I wanted to go about it. And I was better for it. But, you know, it's all relative. I mean, not everyone's quest is going to require the same degree of dedication. I talk about Michael Jordan, right, for example. His mission was to become the best athlete ever in the history of the universe, right? So that's different. And not everyone wants to be a heart surgeon and dedicate all those years to training and things like that. But everybody has that one thing that they're passionate about, and it's going to require a lot. It's not going to – something else is going to have to suffer more than likely.
Absolutely, doctor. Absolutely. And this past Sunday on our radio program, that's exactly what we talked about, and I talked about my story. And how I found my passion was when I had the stroke, and afterwards I learned how other people who didn't have that strength that I have, that motor that I am, when they experienced adversity in their life, whatever it may have been, how the system actually worked against them. And I worked in Europe, in Hamburg, Germany at the time. And the German system is very, very tough. So, and I saw how some people could not recuperate from their adversity and went by the wayside. And I said, I will not have that. And I experienced how the system was against it. So, and this is how I became... I want to do something for people that experience adversity so they don't go by the wayside. That's how the idea started. I didn't know how it was going to be. And I did it, doctor. And you have to, on this journey of when you build and this, that, and the other, you have to be able, to say, okay, I'm not making my six figures. That's okay. I have all the tools built. You have to really eat peanut butter and jelly, because sometimes you just don't have the money.
That's it.
You know,
that's
you keep it. Putting it back into your business, you just don't have the money. So it's really about a worker on the field, out on the open field. You got your arms, your sleeves up, you know, rolled up, and you dig through the trenches. That's what the journey looks like. That's why I can understand that. And that when we're at the end of the field, that we're all rattled, we don't look glamorous, but we have a great mind and a great accomplishment, mentally, emotionally. It's incredible, and that we need to go through our own reinvention process afterwards. That I learned, because I didn't have a coach that could tell me all of this. I was my own coach. I totally understand, doctor, what you went through. And yes, marriage, everything else, there is no time. I'm only speaking for myself. There is no time for anything else. It's just going through it, weathering through it. That's it.
Yeah, and the reason I, at various points throughout the book, I make the point that given today's fixation with instant gratification, you know, the technology is amazing. Technology really made life easier for all of us. But on the one hand, I think we're also a little softer, meaning we're not quite as willing maybe to go that extra mile or be inconvenienced. You know, we're so accustomed to everything is on demand. Movie, food, everything. And so just to illustrate that point, for example, heart surgery training, the way I went through it, 10 years, they were experiencing a calamitous decline in the number of applicants. Literally, it's dropped about 50% over the last 20 years. The number of people actually willing to want to become heart surgeons.
Wow.
Why? Well, it's a lot to sign up for. It's a decade. So much so, in fact, that they've actually restructured how heart surgery training is designed. So now it's truncated to 6 years. It's a long story, but really that's to cater to this sort of newer generation of folks that saying, you know, look, work-life balance, that's what I'm after, and I can't give up that much time to do it. And in my case, it was a no-brainer. I didn't even think about it. I didn't even think twice about it because I wanted it so badly. And it's a different world today. And that's really the point I wanted to get across in that chapter is that, look, if chances are, if it's something really, really worth it, something truly valuable, inspiring, it's going to be work. It's going to be uncomfortable. There are going to be dark days. You know, you're going to have to give up a lot. But it's going to be worth it in the long run.
Absolutely, doctor. Absolutely. And another thing, the complacency we touched, but also the way to victory. What do you mean by that? I'm sure you probably already mentioned it, but let's elaborate a little bit more on that.
The heart way, the victory?
Yes.
Yes. So it obviously one of the key features of the book is that I like to use puns, and I obviously the heart is my favorite organ, and it's my passion, it's what I've dedicated my career to. And I thought it'd be interesting to weave in the word heart or splice it into different phrases or commonly used phrases. And so we always talk about, oh, you know, you like to learn the hard way. You know, we all were chastised with that as youngsters. You do something and you get scolded. Oh, I guess you want to learn the hard way, or you don't want to learn the hard way. So it's a negative connotation.
Oh, okay.
And I flipped it into the heart way, in the sense that the heart, the human heart, literally, it just beats. It just does what it does, no matter what, no matter what state of mind you're in, what circumstances you're in, it just keeps beating, no matter what. And I thought, well, wouldn't life be so much simpler? Wouldn't we be so much more productive if we were kind of like our own, you know, hearts, and we just kept going? We just, no matter what happened, no matter what, you know, hardship, struggle, setback, failure, we just kept moving and moving. Because, you know, so many of us get caught up in reliving that failure and worrying about what other people are thinking.
Yes.
and perseverating. And so we kind of pause. We just let things get to us rather than just keep moving, keep trucking along, like our hearts.
I understand.
So that's what I thought the heart way is a good illustration of that.
Well, doctor, I think you are a perfect role model for that. When they hear your story, and we got to keep going, okay, people do need to detox mentally and emotionally. That's our next Sunday, our topic. We do need to detox mentally and emotionally, but we got to keep going. And that's why I think your book, getting to know your story and who you are, how humble you are, I just love it. I just absolutely adore it. Heart to beat. You're a role model. We got to keep going. Yes. lot of people get stuck. A lot of people get stuck. And this is, I think we can help through our work, both of us and other people who are joining, you know, our roundtable and people that I have in my environment. All people that help, that have a genuine interest in helping people. And that is worthwhile living and getting up every single day and overcoming adversity. Because today, if we don't have the like-minded people, you know, we can always look for new people. We always find the like-minded people. So today's show was about Heart to Beat with Brian Lima, MD.com. Also the second website, hearttobeatbook.com. That's heart and the number two, beatbook.com. Dr. Lima, we're out of time for today.
But thank you so much for having me.
We're looking forward to the to Sunday, the 26th of January, 7 to 8, on WICC on Live Talk with Marietta Radio. So thank you so much, Dr. Lima.
I appreciate
you.
I appreciate it.
Thank you.
All righty. Bye-bye.